Good afternoon, everyone. It's a little after 1, February 21st. The Judiciary Committee is hereby called to order. Present are Representative Lynn, Representative Keller, Representative Pruitt, Representative Gruenberg, and my vice chair is an excused absence, he won't be able to attend, and myself, Chair Gatto. First thing is housekeeping. Remember the rule. If the cell phone goes off, it's not donuts. You get to keep it. Pretty strict rule. Make a double check, huh? Today's agenda, two bills. It's actually my intent to hear these both, and I haven't seen any real opposition. I haven't seen any opposition, to be clear. So unless we have some online, I'm prepared to bring them to a vote. First is HB 56, Arson in Crimes of Conspiracy, of which Representative Gruenberg and I are co-sponsors.
And Representative Lynn.
And Representative Lynn, too. And HB 133, Increasing the Number of Superior Court Judges. Let's go first with the first one, HB 56, Include Arson in Crimes of Conspiracy. And so who is speaking to that one?
Gretchen.
Gretchen. Oh, the famous Gretchen. Have you ever committed arson? No. So you're not speaking from experience. Have you been a firefighter? Been a firefighter? Not yet. Okay, it's coming.
I didn't even light my fireplace.
Okay, proceed, ID.
Good afternoon, Chair Gatto and members of the committee. My name is Gretchen Staft. I am staff to Representative Max Gruenberg. House Bill 56 is very straightforward. All it does is add first and second degree arson to Alaska's conspiracy statute, which would allow someone to be charged with conspiring to commit arson. It was brought to the sponsor's attention last year during a committee hearing that arson was not included in the conspiracy statute. This caused him some concern because obviously if the two or more people conspire to commit an arson, that's not currently a crime. And if a crime is completed involving two or more people, they cannot currently be charged with the two separate crimes of arson and conspiracy. So this just corrects those problems, will add further deterrence to committing the crime of arson. And we spoke with the Department of Law, and they suggested that these changes were appropriate. We asked them, should we include arson in the conspiracy statute? If so, what degrees? They said, yes, they thought it was appropriate, and they felt that specifically first and second degree arson would be appropriate to include because they are the more serious Class A and Class B felonies, and that no, they didn't request that anything else be added into the conspiracy statute. We have not heard any opposition to this bill, and it's highly supported by fire departments, Fire Chiefs Association, Peace Officers Association, things like that. So I'm happy to answer any questions that anybody may have.
Did Representative Gruenberg advise you that back in 2003, he and I sponsored an arson bill back then, and that had to do with compensation for victims of violence or something like that, which had not been included in the list, and that passed easily. So we've kind of come, I don't know about full circle, but we're here. Okay, well, thanks, Gretchen. Andy Carpinetti, you have comments?
And I appreciate it, by the way.
Available for questions?
Just for the record, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your leadership in this area and the leadership of the State Affairs Committee.
Okay. We'll just keep you there available for questions then. Cleo Hill, are you online?
No.
She's with the Fire Marshal's office. I worked with her for I don't know how many years. I'm kind of hoping that you would talk. Fire Chiefs Association, Jeff Tucker.
Yes, Representative Gatto, I want to thank you. Thank you for sponsoring this legislation. And very simply, the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association supports House Bill 56 and encourages its passage and looks forward to being enacted into legislation.
Fair enough. is there anyone else online that wants to testify?
May I just inquire, Mr. Chief?
Representative Gruenberg.
I have on my list Dave Taylor, the state fire marshal. Is he testifying?
I don't have it on my list, so.
This is Gretchen Staft. Unfortunately, he is not able to testify today. He was supposed to testify when the bill was scheduled on Friday, but is unavailable just due to time constraints today.
Thank you.
In all fairness, we had scheduled it for Friday, and it's now Monday, so blame us. So Cleo is not going to testify. Annie is there for questions. Anyone else in the room that wants to testify? Seeing and hearing none, close public testimony. So it brings it back to the committee. Questions from the committee, thoughts, concerns, or challenges? Seeing and hearing none, Representative Keller.
I have a question. Serious.
Would the ultimately, in layman's language, what this does is somebody that is guilty of first degree arson before this bill passes. Can be punished according to the criminal code in a certain way, and does this add by making it a serious felony offense that increases the penalty? Is that essentially it? And I was maybe the Department of Law could just put some of that on the record a little bit.
Perfect.
Get the
Mrs. Carpinetti is here to answer that question for us.
Thank you. My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law, and I agree with everything that Gretchen described in terms of our interaction over this bill. conspiracy would be a separate charge, because there are separate harms there. You have two or more people agreeing to commit a crime, and one of the conspirators doing an act in furtherance of it. So it would be an additional charge. It does not merge into the underlying charge like other anticipatory crimes, solicitation or attempt. So it would be a separate crime. It's not very often prosecuted. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. We looked in the case books, and we don't have many cases where a person is convicted of conspiracy, but it is certainly a useful crime to have available.
Is it because it's so difficult to prove a conspiracy?
I imagine that's
people
correct,
don't
yes.
Just jump up and say, by the way, I like conspiracies, and they always deny them. You can't prove it.
They are more difficult to prove, like any preparatory crime.
Crime of arson is a little easier to prove, but pinning it on someone is more difficult. But usually the fire marshal and the fire captain on any fire can almost always do a fire investigation and tell you where the fire started and how it spread. And furthermore, they know that if a fire started in the kitchen, simultaneously with a fire starting in the living room, two different spots, that is very suspicious. So we have many times, and we usually look for whether insurance was present or is there somebody who gains from this fire. And when you find that the owners lose everything, usually it's not an arson fire. But they're so destructive, even if you escape with your life, and they change your life. So with that, Representative Keller?
Well, I move House Bill 56, version LS0312, Mike, out of committee with attached fiscal note or notes and individual recommendations. Notes.
Is there an objection? Seeing and hearing no objections, House Bill 56 moves from committee. Take a second for an item. on the record for the next bill. We have House Bill 133, which deals with increasing the number of judges. Doug, are you going to speak to that one?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Doug Wolliver. I'm the administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. House Bill 133 and on the Senate side, Senate Bill 58 were introduced by the Rules Committee by a request to the State Supreme Court, which is how we introduce bills, and those every few years the court asks for a bill. This bill will add two new Superior Court judges to the civil bench in Anchorage. In Anchorage, they have criminal judges in the Superior Court and civil judges. These judges will serve on the civil court. There are a couple of reasons for the request. The one is the Anchorage Superior Court judges have by far the highest caseloads of any Superior Court judge, any Superior Court location in the state. They have 687 cases per judge. The next busiest court is Juneau with 570, so over 100 cases fewer per judge in the next busiest court. But necessarily some court's going to be the busiest. So part of the reason for this request is that they are the busiest. They have an unsustainable workload, but there are two factors that are primarily responsible for that. And those two specific case types. One are child need of aid cases, and the other are cases where the parties represent themselves without attorneys in domestic relations cases. The child need of aid cases, we haven't seen an increase so much in our child need of aid filings, and those are cases, if you recall, where the state takes custody of children. We've seen less of an increase, but what we have seen is a significant change in the way judges preside over those cases. Years ago, the standing master, who serves like an assistant to a Superior Court judge, would preside over most of the child need of aid hearings.
Just help me out. A standing master? This is a new term for me and probably the committee. Can you tell us what that
sure.
is?
Mr. Chairman, a standing master works for the Superior Court. They are kind of like specialty judges. They don't have the authority to resolve disputed matters, but they do have the authority to preside over an awful lot of evidentiary type matters. What they end up doing is making a recommendation to a Superior Court judge who has the final decision-making authority.
So they alleviate the workload by presenting agreed upon things that there's no dispute over?
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly right.
Thank you.
And in the past, we've had them do an awful lot of our child in need of aid work. The old system was cases filed, it goes to a standing master. This is the Anchorage practice. It goes to a standing master, and it stays there until there's a contested matter. And then it goes to a Superior Court judge who resolves the contested matter, sends it back to the child need, back to the standing master who handles the case again until there's another contested matter. The problem with that system is the family ends up bouncing back and forth between the standing master and the Superior Court judge. And the Superior Court judge is the one with the final decision-making authority on the case. The judge ends up not being near as familiar with the case as he or she would have been if they'd had the case all along. It does have the benefit of saving Superior Court judge time, but it doesn't serve the families very well. And our current practice now in Anchorage is it starts the same. A child in need of aid case comes in. It goes to a standing master until there's a contested matter. And at that point, it moves permanently to one Superior Court judge. So for the life of that case, and many of these go on for years, that family will always be in front of one judge. It takes more judicial resources, but we think it's a better model. The other thing that judges are doing more and more now are having...
Do the families think it's a better model, or do they say, I don't like this judge, everything he rules, I disagree with? How do I get a new judge? Is that a possibility?
Mr. Chairman, it is a possibility, but you have an opportunity to change or to peremptorily challenge your judge at the beginning of your case. You can't change judges once you're into it and decide you don't like the results very much, but you can change at the very beginning. You say your case is assigned to Judge X, you have a few days, you can say, no, I don't want Judge X, I want a different judge, and you can get that. But the reports we get back from both the attorneys and the families is it's better than bouncing back and forth from one judge to another. And it has the added benefit, just like defense attorneys know and the social workers know, the better you get to know the family, the better you can deal with them. The more you learn about them, the more they trust you. And it's the same with the judge. It's kind of the therapeutic court model where the family gets to know the judge knows the family, and you can make better decisions that way. The other thing we're doing with China cases is we're having a lot more what's called status hearings. Once a family comes into the child need of aid system, there'll be a long laundry list of things they need to do to get their kids back. They may need to go to substance abuse treatment. They may need to get a job. They may need to get that violent boyfriend out of the house. Then a big problem is finding safe and sober housing. They'll have a long laundry list of things to do.
Where are the kids while they're trying to do that?
They can be in any number of places. They could be in foster family, or they can in some cases they stay with the family but monitored by the state. The old practice was to give them the long laundry list of things to do, and then they work with the state to try to address all those needs. What the superior courts are doing now is, rather than just give them this long list and say, "I'll see you in several months," they'll say, "Well, here's the long list. I want to see you in 2 weeks, and let's see if what you've done with treatment. And then I want to see you in 2 more weeks, and we'll focus on the housing." So what we learn in the therapeutic court model for other types of, in the criminal context, is if you have regular appearances before the judge, you're much more likely to stay on track of whatever it is you're trying to accomplish. Remember, the goal of the child need and aid statutes is family reunification. The goal isn't to terminate parental rights. The goal is to get the family healthy and back together and get the kids back in the home. And we think that both by having one judge preside over it and by having a lot of status hearings to keep them on track, we're going to better meet that goal. But it takes more time. More judges are spending more time on child need and aid cases.
Let me ask you a question, though. If we add more judges, do they simply accept part of the load from existing judges, and instead of Judge A sitting in on the bench, it's just Judge B, and Judge A is doing something somewhere else, but not judging? Maybe they're, I don't know.
Pushing.
So that by adding more judges, it's the same number of cases. It's just fewer cases per judge, but we don't get more done. We still have the same number of cases.
Mr. Chairman, we do still have the same number of cases because the court, of course, can't generate cases. They just respond to those that are there. But we do hope to get them done more quickly, which is in the interest of the families who are appearing before them and all the types of cases.
Is that done because with fewer number of cases, the judge probably has this much paperwork and you need time to go through it in order to proceed further?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Judges are the only members of the state government who have to have their work done or they don't get paid. There is a provision in the statutes that says any motion pending on a judge's desk for more than 6 months and that judge doesn't get paid until that matter is resolved. They're the only ones who do this, but it's in the judge's interest, of course, to work through all of those caseloads, and that's why every weekend in Anchorage, you can go to the fourth floor and see an awful lot of Superior Court civil judges working in the weekends, is to try to get through that backlog of cases.
There's any number of people in the community that feel the same way about us. No work, no pay.
No work, no pay. Well, you could always put that in a statute, Mr. Chairman.
We probably won't, but we know about it.
Okay. The other type of case that is significantly impacting the Superior Court caseload are the so-called pro se litigants who come to court, mostly in family law cases, without attorneys. Now, you might think that attorneys just muck things up, but in the court system, the advantage of attorneys, there are a number of them. One, they know what the legal issues are that the court needs to resolve, and they focus on those issues. And two, because they're being paid typically by the hour, and in these cases by the hour by the family, in domestic relations cases, they can't just work nonstop. They don't file tons of motions. The trouble with unrepresented litigants, there are a couple of them. One, they don't tend to focus on the legal issues the court has to resolve. They file a lot of motions because they're free. And they frequently appear in court unprepared with the documents that they need. Nevertheless, the court recognizes that the only way you can get divorced is to go to court. And the court doesn't want the court process to be impossible to access for people who don't have lawyers. People without lawyers have just as many needs as people with lawyers. Their cases are just as important as the ones with attorneys. And our court has decided a number of ways long ago that what we're going to do is try to make the court as accessible as possible. Not all courts have taken this approach. Every court in the country is dealing with unrepresented litigants. Some courts drag their feet and it's really, really difficult to do it without a lawyer. Our court's taken the opposite approach. We have the Family Law Self-Help Center, which has produced well over 100 different forms for people who are unrepresented to try to get their case resolved through the courts without having to hire an attorney. We think this is a better system. We think it's more fair to the citizens. But we end up with an awful lot of pro se litigants in our court. Right now, about 66% of our family law cases have at least one side unrepresented. Only 33% have lawyers on both sides. And even those with lawyers on both sides, when they file, frequently drop one or both along the way. These cases are a lot of extra work, but we're helping them by having our Family Law Self-Help Center. But they're a lot of work, and it takes a lot more time for the judges to resolve these cases.
So the Family Law Self-Help Center can resolve the whole thing and never go beyond that, as long as the parties agree?
Mr. Chairman, no. All they do is direct people to the types of forms and things that can help them move through the process. They don't give legal advice, but we have our Family Law Self-Help Center is an amazing form-generating machine, and you can do an awful lot in the court process with good forms that it's incredibly difficult to do without forms.
So do we have something called arbitration where we never get to the Family Help Center? We just have a person representing the courts who says, listen, let's try to settle this before we go and get very complicated.
Mr. Chairman, we have a mediation program. We have family law mediation. We have pro bono attorneys in Anchorage who are working on a project that is settling cases. We've got we have one of our judges who's just retired who's coming back with a settlement emphasis to try to move these cases through the system without having to constantly appear before Superior Court judges. In fact, we have a whole kind of suite of options we're coming up with to try to, when cases come in, we have staff review those cases, triage them, say, okay, which one needs to go to settlement, which one can go to mediation, which one's going to have to go to a Superior Court judge, and we're trying to manage those cases better. That's the situation in Anchorage, why we're asking for two new judges, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Committee members? I'm a little curious about all the fiscal notes. We have one, the first one, the Alaska Court System, looking for 8 full-time positions, and the total is about a trying to see what the difference is here. Let's say 8 full-time positions, and that goes on forever. That's the first fiscal note we have from the Alaska Court System with your name on it.
Yes. When you hire a Superior Court judge, you get there's support staff to go with the judge. There's a law clerk. There's an in-court clerk. There's an administrative assistant and the judge.
And the total for these 8 people?
The total operating expenses are $930,000. For those 8 positions. The extra $425,000 is a capital request to create one new courtroom. That money is also in our capital budget request. It was funded by the legislature last year, which is remodel money for the Boney Courthouse. It was funded by the legislature last year but vetoed by the governor. It's in our capital budget as well, so if the capital budget passes as we've asked, it comes out of this note. If not, then this note would be the capital expense.
Okay. Can you comment also while you're in the hot seat? Alaska Judicial Council also has a fiscal note. That's the second one we have.
I probably can. They'd be better at it than me, but
is someone here from there that could testify, or I'm relying on you because I didn't catch that anyone else.
We've had Mr. Chairman, we've had notes before from judicial counsel. The process they go through. There'll be two more judicial application periods for two more positions. They'll interview a whole bunch of different people, and through that process, then they'll send names up to the governor. The judicial counsel is made up of volunteers and a very small staff, paid staff, but these are the costs that they estimate are associated with filling two more judicial vacancies, and then the retention elections later on for each one of those judges.
Yeah. Well, it has under total operating, 2012 is 1.9, goes all the way across 1.9, but in the very first line, it talks about 23,200 by itself, and it's under total operating. So it appears like we've got bigger numbers to add up as opposed to all the out years.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not that familiar with their note. I'm just looking on their back page. They show a breakdown of the one that adds up to 23, mm-hmm. another one adds up to 13. All I can say in short is just the cost reflected in selecting and retaining judges, yeah. more judges.
I was just looking at contractual printing, mailing, survey, hosting, data analysis, advertising, miscellaneous, $14,100. Mm-hmm. I thought that was, I don't know if it's high or low, but it just caught my eye because it seemed high. However, we'll go on to the next one now. Next fiscal note is from the Department of Administration.
Mr. Chairman, again, they'd be better at it than me, but anytime you add new judges, I'm going to steal Mr. Savotny's line here. He told me beforehand, more judges mean more hearings. So almost any time you add new judges, there are more cases active in any given moment for the attorneys to handle. There's either another courtroom to cover or cases are moving more quickly. But when I gave an overview of the judiciary here before this committee at the very beginning of session, I talked about how the whole justice system is integrated. You know, if you add more police, you're going to probably need more prosecutors, defense attorneys, sure. and judges. And it works backwards, too. If you add more judges, you're probably going to need more public defenders, Office of Public Advocacy, and prosecutors, or Civil Division of the Department of Law in this case.
And they require some office space that currently doesn't exist, so it's going to be some capital expenditures.
New sets
of law books, maybe new pens and pencils.
All those types of expenses that come with adding staff, Mr. Chairman.
And a big gavel. We have someone else here. The next. Sue, do you handle corrections? No, so I will have to ask Doug that one then. Here we go. The next fiscal note is Department of Administration again. Two new Superior Court judges. I think that one might be the easiest one.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there'll be two from the Department of Administration, one from the Public Defender Agency and one from the Office of Public Advocacy, and they both do child need of aid cases.
And Quinlan Steiner, are you on the available?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Quinlan Steiner with the Public Defender Agency.
Okay, as a public defender, can you address any of the questions we had on the fiscal notes?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Wolliver's assessment of the pressure upon us is essentially correct. If you add judges, there's more hearings and more upfront workload. In addition, with regard to civil cases, there's presently 10 Superior Court judges handling child in need of aid matters, which we're responsive to. We only have 6 attorneys. So we actually have an issue getting attorneys in the courtrooms on a daily basis. With the addition of 2 judges handling these matters and scheduling hearings, we'll just have a simple problem of getting more or getting our attorneys in front of those judges. So we'd need to add a position regardless of the workload. But in addition, there is, you know, the upfront workload.
Well, we had no doubt it would come down to additional public defenders. But thanks for your comments.
Certainly.
So the next one I have is Department of Corrections. And my understanding is that fiscal note is inaccurate. At least that's the information that came down to me. If there was someone who could testify as to that fiscal note. They talk about division of probation and parole workloads, felony pre-sentence investigations, pre-sentence report, production for Superior Court, requiring the addition of one full-time adult probation officer to handle up to 12 reports each month.
Mr. Chairman, when I first submitted my fiscal note on this bill, and the bill itself doesn't distinguish between criminal judges and civil judges. I imagine when the Department of Correction saw that we were adding two new judges, that they didn't have any reason to know it would just be on a civil caseload, but it will just be on a civil caseload, and they won't be affecting pre-sentence reports or felony crimes or anything related to criminal justice.
Okay. We've been joined by Representative Holmes, and while I'd love to go back over everything we covered, I'm
You're not going
not
to.
Going to.
That's fair, Mr. Chairman.
We did pass out the first bill, and we're dealing now only with the one on addition of judges. And with that, I do have yet another one here, Office of the Governor, which is a zero fiscal note, so that's easy. And then AST, Lieutenant Rodney Dial submitted that one. And there's some serious money in that one, too. Single full-time position. Rodney Dial, are you on available? Lieutenant Dial. I didn't think he would be. His name is not down here, but I could see the addition of one trooper, and the amount of money for the one trooper looks like it's in line with what troopers normally cost.
Mr. Chairman, we have Sue Stancliffe here from the department.
And I talked about her just a minute ago.
Did you? Uh-oh, I hope
and
you
she's
said
still
nice.
Here. I thought we scared you away. So I accused her of being answering for Department of Corrections, and she gave me the uh-uh sign, and I took that to mean everything. But no. So, since Lieutenant Dial is not on the air, you're in front of us, please proceed.
Today is a holiday, and he has the day off.
Yeah, good for him.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sue Stancliffe, Special Assistant to the Commissioner for Department of Public Safety. I can address this fiscal note. Court Service Officer is the position that we would be requesting to be added. It is different from a trooper, but it is a Court Service Officer housed under the detachments of the Alaska State Troopers. These are civil cases. Normally, a court service officer would be in the courtroom handling, order, if you will, and they primarily do transportation in criminal cases, handling of the paperwork, etc. In these particular cases, because of the additional courtroom, we believe that there would need to be a court services officer to handle that. Two judges, but only one courtroom. So we think that if with the one judge we can handle that with the staffing we have currently, but if we add another courtroom, then we believe that we will need another CSO. Having said that, the unrepresented litigants is frequently in family law, these become emotional and very difficult cases for the families. They do occasionally require, the assistance of a court service officer, and we believe that we would need to have at least one.
And one of the lines, it says, court service officers serve documents in accordance with instructions from the courts, et cetera, et cetera.
Do they do process serving?
Good question. I don't know the answer to that.
Well, Jane is giving me the up They're and down behind head me motion. Shaking, I'm
yes.
going with Jane.
as is Mr. Svodny and Woolover, yes.
Okay, it's unanimous.
Yes.
Unanimous. They do that, too.
Yes.
Okay.
So we did try, Mr. Chairman, we did try to keep the cost down and did not include the cost of a vehicle. They're not transporting in civil cases. We don't believe, you know, we've nipped it down as far as we possibly could.
Okay. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Is there anyone else online that wants to testify? Hearing none, I'm going to close public testimony, but I reserve my chairman's privilege of reopening it. I'm going to hold this bill over until we get something from corrections and to see, because I don't want to move it without with this question mark that's stuck in here. So with that being done, it's possible for us to revisit now some of our Well, I'm going to take that back. I wanted to hear more on 127, but we are waiting for some very important paperwork, which would be all be repeated if we took it up now. We'd have to almost repeat it all again later. So with that, we've really covered our work for the day. Does the committee have any questions about the judges' bill, adding the two judges and all those physical notes that are in front of us? Seeing and hearing none, I'm going to then close judiciary. We are adjourned.